Savory Inferiors, and welcome to Vampire Insider, the unofficial podcast dedicated to recapping and reacting to AMC's new Immortal Universe shows, including Interview with the Vampire and The Mayfair Witches. In each episode, host Joanne Palumbo, Christina LaRusso, and myself, Mark Snedeker, summarize the episode, talk about Easter eggs, discuss standout characters, interrogate inconsistencies between the book and the series, and dissect our favorite characters and their arc, and we provide a body count. We are now mid-season, so as we're waiting for Mayfair Witches, we want to explore some of the more interesting topics presented by the show. Today, we are joined by Dominique, whose Twitter handle is at EMOS_QUE. They are a history student and provided a very interesting thread about the historical background of the show. Dominique, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much, Mark. I'm so glad to be here. This is my first podcast ever.
Also, I'd like to welcome my co-hosts, Christina LaRusso and Joanne Palumbo. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Christina, why don't you talk a little bit about the framework you envision here?
Well, I would just like to extend a very warm thank you to Dominique for appearing with us. Dominique, as Mark mentioned, did a thread that I found absolutely fascinating. As a historian myself, when I saw the level of research that they did, I was thrilled, and I reached out immediately and said, hey, would you please be on the podcast? And they were warm and welcoming. So, Dominique, there's kind of two things you want to discuss. You want to talk about some of the history, and I've got one little historical thing that I've dug into myself. And then also you want to discuss Elektra and how that might provide us with some insight into what's going on the show. But before we get to that, I would like to ask you, how did you come to the series, or did you first read the books? What is your sort of background with the material?
My English teacher in like sixth grade, I think, she was obsessed with the books and the movie as well. And this was back in 2014, 2015, someone around that. She once recommended to me, because, you know, I've always been friends with history and literature teachers. So she recommended to me the books. And I'm not gonna lie, I've read only the three first books, Interview with the Vampire, Vampire Lestat, and Queen of the Damned. I watched the movie, the 1994 movie, and watched the show. That's it.
Are vampires or the supernatural, witches and things like that, is that something that you're interested in as a genre generally, or is it just this subject matter?
I like vampires a lot. I had a weird obsession with mermaids when I was a child, but nowadays I kind of like the genre. I watch pretty much everything that comes out that's related to vampires and things like that. But I like to study how those things originated, you know, the stories, the myths.
Did you watch Vampire Diaries?
I didn't.
Oh my God. I gotta go.
I'm so sorry.
You're not a vampire fan if you don't watch them.
Yeah, we didn't watch either, Dominique. So that's Joe on her own.
That's my obsession, but I highly recommend it.
So one question that I wanted to pose to you as a fellow historian is, overall, how do you think they're doing integrating the history into the series? What is your kind of hot take?
I think they're doing great. I mean, I'm not an expert on Louisiana in the early 20th century, but the tiny details they're adding, like the blue book Lestat is holding when he appears for the first time, like that is such a tiny detail about everything, and it's great.
I was actually going to say the same thing referencing the blue book, because I remember when we did our recap of episode one, that was something that I was focused on. And I remember saying, like, it just goes to show you even the teeniest, tiniest detail they really managed to bring to light, like just having that book, but it was so easy to overlook it. So I'm glad that Dominique picked up on that as well. It makes me feel better because having someone who's, you know, a historian see that and go, yeah, that was pretty significant. So for me, yeah, I think that they've done a fabulous job with it. It's definitely taught me some stuff because I didn't know anything about Storyville. So I had a great time like kind of digging into that and learning all about it. I had no clue that New Orleans had sort of a red light district of its own. And I've learned a bit, but I've also enjoyed just seeing the stuff that they've, you know, put forward for us to kind of pick up on. So it's been fun.
Joanne, for someone who didn't know that there was a red light district in New Orleans, you spent a lot of time there when we were visiting this.
Girls got to make a buck.
Oh, I didn't know that you were. I thought you were maybe a patron.
I was working. Oh, you were,
she's a consultant.
It was a working trip.
Joanne was the face consultant.
Oh, gosh. Okay. As Christina will attest, I am no expert historian, but I mean, it does appear that they've gone to pretty great lengths to make sure that they include accurate historic details. Now, of course, you have to bend things a little bit in order to keep the narrative structure alive, but it does seem like they did pay a lot of attention, especially in that first few years there in New Orleans. We'll wait and see how they do in post-World War II Europe or possibly during World War II Europe.
I am going to agree. And I found that they're weaving such a rich historical tapestry. And one of the things that you mentioned, Mark, in about the first episode was how even the art direction seems to be creating a mood. And they did that with the lighting. Remember, yeah, you commented that it was almost like a sepia toned, yep, lighting. So that they really did a good job, I think, of embedding the audience into that time frame. I also appreciate what they did in the season finale with the costumes for, you know, sort of the Marie Antoinette. Now, they're very stylized costumes.
Right.
But what that says to me is that same level of detail that they brought to framing this portion of the series, they are going to apply that same level when they do go back in time, because Lestat is from that time.
Yeah.
But I'm a medieval historian. So medieval to sort of the time of the voyages of discovery and a little bit beyond that. So all of that really old history, that's the stuff that I'm interested in. Okay. So Dominique, why don't you start out for us talking to us a little bit about the historical stuff that you uncovered?
All right, let's start with Storyville. Not everyone is fluent in English. There was this thing called Red Light District. In this time, prostitution was illegal, but there was a lot of people breaking the law. So what they did, what the government did, was let's take a few blocks of New Orleans and let's make prostitution legal within these blocks. So why would you break the law while you could do that thing you wanted to do legally? So everyone migrated to Storyville to do prostitution. And so the government could keep an eye on those things because it was all in one area. It's called Storyville because the alderman, he was called Sidney Story. And so the Storyville was named after him. It started in mid-1890s, in that decade. It wasn't very popular until around 1905. But starting from like the 1905, it became so popular. And it became so popular, in fact, people started to get lost inside that place because it was growing and it was very, very lively. So they decided to create tour guides. And those tour guides were literally like small magazines, were called Blue Books. They were created, I think, since 1895 until its closure in 1917. From those blue books, you could see the names of all the ladies that worked there, and as well as the saloons. And that small book, Lestat is holding when he appears for the first time, is a blue book you can see on the cover. It's very interesting to me how when he met Louis, he said, "Oh, I didn't know who you were. I'm meeting you for the first time." And it's possible that if Louis was as big as he said he was in that time, it was possible his name was under the saloons in the blue book. So Lestat was either lying to Louis already, or he wasn't in the blue book.
Now, wasn't Brickhead actually in the blue book?
Bricktop.
I can't help it. I just call her Brickhead.
I call her Brick House.
So Bricktop was actually a madam in right. New Orleans, but many, many years before this.
Oh, gotcha.
So she was not listed. Okay, one of the things that I find very interesting about the blue books is that you can actually access them online. Did you go and look at some online?
Yeah, I went to the Historic New Orleans Collection mm-hmm. online. They have a site. I looked through some of them looking for the names of Bricks and Lily. I will tell you, I found a Lily Connor.
That's awesome.
That is really cool.
Oh, so Lily was a real person.
Of course, I don't know if it was actually her, because in the we don't get a last name in the show.
Oh, true, true.
I think in the 1903 blue book, under the saloon of Josie Arlington, there is a girl that worked there named Lillian Connor.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if they, you know, plucked that out of there.
If they did, yeah. Why? They obviously knew what they're doing. Anybody who's interested in seeing this really fascinating resource online, the address is www.hnoc.org, and you can click through it and it will get you to the blue books. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I did for the team when they were preparing the Azalea Hall commercial, the funny commercials that we put into each of the episodes, I pointed them in the direction of the blue book. And I think that, didn't you guys take some of the verbiage?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely did for my commercial. And I loved that, you know, when you're kind of flipping through the pages, it's not just, okay, go to this saloon and this is who's there. And, you know, the names of the girls and some pictures and some information about them. But they also had advertisements for businesses in there. So it really was just like a little magazine. And I would even when we would do the ads for like the incinerator, Christina, I would reference that again because I went to see like how they talked about the ads. I did that, I know, especially with the funeral parlor. It was actually a very helpful resource to, you know, to go back to see what type of verbiage they used and the way they said things and stuff like that. So, it's a really fun thing to kind of thumb through. And I recommend that everybody kind of checks it out.
All right. So one of the other things that I wanted to say about Storyville is that originally you pointed out that one of the aldermen, it was given the nickname Storyville because of his last name. And initially he was very upset by that, but eventually he kind of got on board and realized it was an affectionate nickname. And so he was really kind of pleased. They also called it the Tenderloin instead of Storyville.
Well, a lot of cities have a Tenderloin.
Yeah. Well, San Francisco does.
There you
the
go.
Tenderloin.
Boston does.
The other thing that I wanted to say about Storyville, for those who are interested in the history of it, one of the things that, and Dominique, I'm wondering if you had a chance to look at it. Ernest, he goes by E.J. Bullock. Ernest Joseph Bullock was a professional photographer and is famous for having taken a bunch of pictures of prostitutes from Storyville.
Oh, yeah, I read about that, but I didn't go like very further into it because I had a lot to talk about in that thread.
Yeah, so you saw it. So I would say to others, because the photographs of them, of the prostitutes, are very poignant to me. Some of them are racy, but some of them they're dressed in furs. So you can kind of see the different sort of levels of right. women who were working there. And I just find that very poignant. And as a matter of fact, they made a film that was kind of loosely based on his exploits in Storyville. And Joanne, I referenced that a while ago. Pretty Baby with Brooke Shields when Brooke Shields was very young.
Yes, I remember you talking about that.
That film would never be made today. One of the other things that I find fascinating about Storyville and that I think bears discussion a little bit, or at least to be noted, is the fact that this was the first time that people were segregated by gender. So women who were prostitutes were expected to live in that district. That is where they were expected to live. Now, some of them lived outside of it, but most of them did what they were told to do. And they lived in that district so that they could practice their trade. And this is the first time that people were segregated by gender. And the law that upheld that and said that that was a legal and right thing to do was Plessy versus Ferguson, which is a law that is obviously famous for the racial separate but equal laws.
Yeah. Not one of our finest.
Not a fine moment for the United States.
We have a lot of unfine moments.
We have really bad, terrible moments in history.
As a Latin American, yeah, a lot of unfine moments.
Hey, you guys need some freedom over there? We're on our way.
Oh, God. Yeah, some of us are really sorry about that.
Okay, so the reason they call that area, which is typically red light district, the Tenderloin, is because there was a policeman in New York that called an area the Tenderloin because he got so many bribes from those areas he could afford to eat tenderloin steak. So then that just became kind of a buzzword for the red light district. And of course, now a lot of cities have the Tenderloin. Although now in San Francisco, the Tenderloin is actually a very fashionable part of the city. And you know, one of the better places to live. So,
well, it's interesting because of course that too was true of the Storyville. It is corrupt. I mean, whenever you have things like prostitution, sure, gambling, that kind of business, there's a lot of kind of shady things that go on with it. And Louis speaks to that. He says you couldn't look weak on Liberty.
Yeah.
And you saw that he was, you know, we see in the series that he's living that life as a pimp and what that means and how he has to, and how his family kind of want to distance themselves from it, in particular Paul. But even his mother says, well, Louis will get us into something more respectable soon. And she has confidence. And Louis is like, well, this is the thing that's making us money.
He's like, I look, next on my agenda is becoming an immortal monster that eats, that drinks blood. I don't know if that's what you had in mind, Mom.
And that'll never happen. So,
but that's where I'm going. So just so you know, get a little future prepping here for you.
Exactly.
I love that his mom said, well, Louis will find us something more, you know, clean. And he said, well, how can I make money in a clean way? And he saw a super rich French guy. And he said,
This guy looks like he has it all together.
That French white.
Yes, I will get a wealthy boyfriend.
So you talked about how there were many shady things happening on Storyville. And now I want to talk about Thomas Anderson.
Oh,
yeah, he was very real. And he, in fact, existed. And he was known in Storyville as the unofficial mayor of Storyville because he had so much money and he controlled so many of the saloons. And he was actually friends with the New Orleans Department Police. So he just run the place, you know. He actually had a saloon called the Fair Play Saloon, but it changed names. It was created in 1895, I guess, and changed names right before the 20th century began. It was all real and very detailed.
Wow. So Tom, in real life, not an upstanding character, and that is mirrored in the show.
Yeah. Remind us how that worked out for him. Did that go well?
It didn't. Well, it didn't in the show. Is that accurate to his real life, though?
Was he really killed by a vampire?
Well, he wasn't really killed by a vampire. Oh. But Dominique, do you know what happened to him in real life?
After Storyville was closed in 1917, he began running Spexus's, still in New Orleans in the 1920s, and he was arrested at some time, but he was liberated because he was friends with the police, so Yeah, he had a nice life. I'm not gonna lie.
Looks like he died in 1931. So he was dead by the time the events of Interview with the Vampire would have occurred, because that was the late 30s when the finale is. And
well, he was dead then. He just didn't know it.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, see, he's an interesting character for sure. And definitely somebody that here again, I like their choices that they're making, where they take real life figures and they put them into the show.
And they even did that, obviously, with the musicians. I mean, you know, with Jelly Roll Morton,
yes,
and things like that. And they really left. And I'm sure a lot of shows do it, but, you know, I really appreciate their efforts in that, and just incorporating as much of the real world into it to, you know, kind of solidify this fake universe.
You know what I really like about the way they did it? Because it's really easy when you do something like that to kind of make it Forrest Gump, right? Where every single significant person of that age, they just happened to stumble across. But they did it Jelly Roll Morton is probably the most famous person that they interacted with, although they mentioned some other ones, right? I mean, Marie Antoinette, for example. Mm-hmm. But they didn't fall into that trap where they're like, you know what, we could just have, you know, I don't know, whoever, Teddy Roosevelt stroll through the scene or something, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that because that would have really made it, that would have cheapened it and made it just kind of, you know, a gimmick. But what they did was they tried to do it in a richer, you know, subtler way. And I think I really do appreciate that's how they approached it.
Well, he does talk, for instance, okay, Joanne, you bring up the musician Jelly Roll Morton. They also, later on, Lestat says to him, it mentions Louis Armstrong, and
right,
he said it could be the Night of Two Louis or something
right.
Louis Armstrong was there. Mm-hmm. He was there. He began as a musician there. I agree with you, Mark. I also think that putting him there to meet the characters would be kind of cheap.
So let's talk a little bit about the ending of Storyville. In the series, it has this very kind of crashing end, which is, you know, the fire that happens. But in real life, this is right around the time of America entering World War I. There were like three or four soldiers who were spending some time in Storyville who were killed. And they had wanted to kind of crack down on the prostitution as it was. And now they determined, well, you know what, this is too much of a temptation for our boys who are stationed near here and about to go to war. So we're going to shut it down. And that ends up happening. They do close it down, but it's not quite as dramatic as with the fire and the Fenwick getting put up on the poles at Jackson Square. That
would have been a cooler way for it to go on.
It would have.
But it is a little inconvenient for like half your fighting force to be suffering from VD. You
know, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's probably,
yeah,
it know, would. Not great.
About the closure of Storyville, I had one tiny bit of information, because when the United States entered World War I, the government was like, okay, there cannot be any saloons, there, even within the red light district, there cannot be one saloon within about 5 mile radius, any military base. Storyville wasn't near any military base, but it was coastal, so there were ports, and the Storyville port was the last place the marine boats containing the soldiers to the war in Europe stopped before going to Europe. So everyone got like really drunk and entered the boat and went to the war. And, you know, it was pure chaos. So even though Storyville was entirely inside the rules they created, they were like, all right, let's close this one as well.
1917, we're moving towards, we're 3 years out from Prohibition in the United States. There is definitely a movement that is, you know, temperate and focused on evangelicalism and religious, you know, more of a focus on religion and sort of keeping men at home and the, you know, the demon liquor and all of that. So it is not surprising.
You said demon liquor, and I wasn't, I unfocused for a second. I'm like, who's out there licking demons? What the hell is wrong with them?
No, demon liquor. So it totally tracks from that perspective, right? It was going to be closed. They just use that as an excuse. So one of the things that I see happening in the series that I like, that I wish would maybe they would do a little bit more of, is there's a history for Louis that he is trying to express to Lestat, and that has to do with his race. I think what Louis is really trying to do is get Lestat to understand that his struggles that he faces on a day-to-day basis with his race in the Jim Crow South is not alleviated by his vampirism. We've talked about this multiple times, that we think Lestat sort of looks at it and says, you're a vampire now. Your race shouldn't matter, right? Like, you're an all-powerful vampire. None of that should factor. And we've seen Lestat kind of do microaggressions to Louis around his race and sort of be dismissive when Louis does try to talk to him, particularly about when he killed the attorney and the guy who dabbled in fuckery, Joe. He said, Lestat's like, oh, this again, you know, here we are again. And so there's kind of for Lestat this eye rolling, and it's not fair to Louis. And so there's one scene that I wanted to talk about, and that is in episode 3, Is My Very Nature That of the Devil? It starts out with Louis and Lestat in Jackson Square, and they're reading on their bench. And Lestat is reading about the history of Jackson Square. He's relaying to Louis what he's reading, that this is where the Louisiana Purchase was signed. And he, as a Frenchman, had disdain for the Louisiana Purchase because, of course, remember, he lived through it. He remembered it happening. And he says that's a penny wise and frank foolish. And then Louis says to him, does it say anything about how they used to take runaway slaves, cut their heads off, and pike them on the iron gates as a warning? And for me, when I heard him say that, I thought, this is the bid for Lestat's attention around, hey, do you understand what is going on here and what has gone on here to people of color? And Lestat says, well, you know, he's dismissive. He said, well, I'm only halfway through. Let's see where I get. So what I wanted to do is attach that to a little bit of history and talk about a little bit of the history around that subject. True enough, Jackson Square historically was a place where executions were carried out. And historically, I found two events that kind of fit into what is clearly a part of Louis's cultural memory. We talk a lot about how memory it works in Interview with the Vampire. And one of the ways I think it does for Louis is this cultural memory. Now, on the one hand, he is the great grandson, I guess, of a plantation owning man of color who owns slaves. And then on the other hand, he is a man who right now himself is situated in the Jim Crow South and all of the restrictions that come with that. So the first thing he could have been referring to was the execution of a runaway slave and a founder of what was called a maroon colony. Maroons were often escaped slaves and their descendants who formed settlements away from prevailing power structures. So they would often make settlements in the bayou or in swampy areas, and they intermingled with marginalized Native American populations. So in this case, this guy's name was Jean St. Malo. He ran away from a plantation and joined a band of others who had settled in a swampy area outside of New Orleans. And at that time, New Orleans was under Spanish control. And so this is in like 1783. And they obtained weapons. The settlement obtained weapons from free people of color and plantation slaves and established a headquarters in present day St. Bernard Parish. And so attempting to quash slave revolts, the Spanish colonial authorities organized a campaign to round up escaped slaves. Jean St. Malo was captured. He was condemned to death and executed in front of St. Louis Cathedral, which is next to present day Jackson Square. So it wasn't Jackson Square yet at that time because it was still under Spanish control. All right. So the other event that he may have been referring to, and I think this one actually fits a little bit better, was called the 1811 German Coast Uprising. So this essentially was a slave uprising. And slave uprisings in the South were always things that the plantation owners were terrified of having happen because honestly, they were outnumbered. So what happened in early January of 1811, and this is during a time when the workload for slaves was relaxed after the sugar harvest, for 2 days, insurrectionists, slave insurrectionists marched along the Sugar Coast in Louisiana, gathering momentum and followers as they went. So they would go from plantation to plantation, and then slaves would join in. This was mostly younger men with who did low skill plantation jobs. And there are historians suspect that there could have been up to 500 slaves that joined this sort of revolt. They eventually met resistance from a hastily joined planter militia. The revolting slaves only killed two men, but the slaves, they were essentially massacred. Several of the leaders were captured in the swamps, and they were summarily executed upon capture with no trial given. But in the 2 weeks following the uprising, the militia rounded up an additional 45 men and boys, and they were tried, and many were executed. And the executions were carried out in what was then called the Place d'Armes, which Lestat remarked upon in the scene that I mentioned as preferable to Jackson Square. And they were generally done by hanging or firing squad. And the heads of the executed men were mounted on pikes to warn the others. So I think that that's probably more of what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Because they were actually piked. That is the history that Louis refers to. And I think that that's important to note, because his other part of his history is that of the descendant of a slave owning plantation owner.
Yeah.
But he has more affinity towards, it seems, you know, towards these young men who were executed just because they wanted to be free.
The thing that you said about, that you talked about, Lestat, eye rolling every time Louis talked about his race struggles in that society. I think it's because Lestat sees racism more like a situational thing than a systemical, because he sees it as someone is racist to you, so you simply can kill them and it ends. But it doesn't end, because Lestat is queer, so he kind of suffers with prejudice as well. But it's not, of course, it's not as heavy as racism, because if someone finds out Lestat is queer and begins being a homophobic towards him, yes, he can just kill the person. And yeah, he cannot marry and etc. and all the terrible things inside homophobia. But for him, it's much more a situation than a system. Louis, like, he can attend to a lot of places. He can enter a lot of places. That's what Lestat can't see, in my opinion.
I think that that's a fantastic way to look at it. Situational versus systemic.
Right. So, I mean, I agree with everything that was said, because it's, you know, essentially with Lestat coming from a completely different background in the way that Europeans viewed racism, not that I'm excusing his tossing Louis's feelings aside, but to him, it wasn't an issue. And he really should have respected Louis more with understanding that it was an issue for him, but.
And not, maybe not the most empathetic person of all.
He's not. And I want to add in, much of Lestat's characterization, I think, is coming from the vampire Lestat.
Right.
I think that most of what you see this Lestat acting like is they've gleaned from the vampire Lestat, because the personality of Lestat in Interview of the Vampire is radically different from Vampire Lestat.
Just shit.
Very, very different guy. Yeah. Okay. So he's got that Vampire Lestat charisma happening already in this series. When we do the book review of the Vampire Lestat, we're going to talk about it. Lestat is coming from what he thinks is a very enlightened age and an age
I think they called it the enlightenment, the age of enlightenment.
Well, it is. And they're making this break from the sort of superstitions of religion and sort of the heavy duty Catholicism. There's this break away from that. And he's insensitive about it.
He thinks he's above it, right?
He's
like, oh, I'm European. We don't do that. I'm enlightened. I don't think about things like that.
I'm not superstitious.
I happen to be Lily White, so whatever, but.
You know, and he promises Louis, I will take you, I will give you this dark gift, and it will remove these things that you have to deal with, but it doesn't remove those things.
He thinks that making Louis no longer human will remove these human prejudices as impacts on him, but obviously that is not the case.
Yeah.
All right, so I have a question. And now, Joanne, as non-historians, we probably feel a little bit like a third wheel right now. So I'm going to, this is going to be a discussion with you and me.
Ooh, I'm excited.
You know, we have an idea about the historical setting that Louis and Lestat are in, right?
Right.
Which historical fact, if you can isolate one, do you think had the biggest impact on this story this season, for season one?
I would have to go with anything surrounding race. Example of it would be something so basic as planning a trip, right? Like, I understand racism in the country, obviously, but the little nuances of things like that, I should say, when Louis gives his sister the honeymoon and explains that their trip, the first part, so they're in steerage, but then he said, once you get to Europe, it's first class all the way. It didn't dawn on me. Like, I listened to it and I was like, in my mind, I said, why did he cheap out getting them there, but is sparing no expense once they're there? And Christina explained it to me because in Europe, at, you know, obviously at that time, it racism wasn't nearly as prevalent as it was in America, obviously, because we suck. So Black people or people of color, as we saw with when Claudia was on the train, Black people don't sit up in first class or even on the bus when they were, if you remember when they were like going hunting or whatever for people and like Lestat was a few seats ahead of them. It wasn't because he didn't want to sit with them. It's because Black people had to sit towards the back of the bus. Back to the trip. I found that, you know, really interesting that it was because of, you know, the sister and the husband were people of color that they could not be put into first class. And, you know, it's one of the few times in history that money didn't speak, because normally money will buy you anything. But even when it comes to racism, money doesn't matter, apparently. You know, I just think that's a really good thing that they covered in terms of the show. What would you say, Mark?
I think the racial politics is probably the biggest, right? Because that really drives Louis. Mm-hmm. And he's the center of our story, even though everybody, you know, stands Lestat or loves Claudia, and they're great characters and great actors. But really, this is a Louis-centric story. Sadly, in that age, that would have been the single largest impact on his life. It dictates where he can go, where he can't go, how he can earn a living. It has that sense that at any time, and this is obviously when he was pre-vampire, but at any time, your life is in danger more so than your white counterparts, mm-hmm. right? You could just be rousted by a police officer for no other reason than you were a person of color.
And not much has changed.
I mean, you're right. I mean, that is still an issue, and that you can't really overestimate the impact that that kind of stress and anxiety has on someone's personality. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, maybe in season two, possibly the war might have a bigger impact on the story. We'll have to wait and see kind of on that, but that might be an interesting change of tone. We shall see. Mm-hmm. But I think the racial politics is probably the biggest one.
Dominique, the other thing that you wanted to talk about was Elektra. So how would you like to introduce that subject?
Basically, it's a story about a guy who ran the city of Argos, and he was called Agamemnon. He had a wife called Clytemnestra. He also had a brother called Menelaus. And this brother Menelaus was married to Helen of Troy. Helen was kidnapped. Menelaus was, oh my god, my wife got kidnapped. What do I do? Agamemnon was like, my brother is blood of my blood. I will help you. So the Trojan War happened. While that happened, Clytemnestra started seeing a guy called Aegisthus. They decided, well, when your husband gets back, we'll just kill him and take his throne. And when Agamemnon came back from the war, they did so. And Agamemnon had some children, but the two important ones are Orestes and Elektra, brother and sister. After their father's death, Aegisthus was terrified that Orestes would get revenge sometime. An old servant of Agamemnon managed to get Orestes out of Argos before Aegisthus could kill him. But Elektra stayed there. And so both Orestes and Electra hate their mother for betraying their father. And that's the story, basically.
Okay, so how are you going to apply this story to Interview with a Vampire?
Electra is full of hate towards her mother, the person who created her. Electra is Claudia, Clytemnestra. Is Lestat, of course, he created both Louis and Claudia and betrayed Louis. Louis is both Agamemnon and Orestes because he plays both the role of father and brother of Claudia.
From the maker's standpoint, they are siblings. Louis and Claudia are siblings because their sire is Lestat. But Louis plays this paternal role. But then also Claudia once she comes home after she's gone away for her college years and she comes back and she's watching him in the cemetery. And she says, they created me to be his sister. I struggled with that a little bit when she said it. But now with this reading and bringing up Electra, it's causing me to stop and I've got to rewatch this now and look at it through that lens.
The thing is, for a woman to have a man of any kind related to her was essential to her existence in that society. So after her father is killed and her brother has to run away to not also be killed, she doesn't have a man at all. She doesn't have a husband, she doesn't have a father, she doesn't have a brother. So she's essentially alone and invalidated by society. So a lot of times throughout the play, when Orestes gets back, he plans to kill their mother, and he does so. And the rest of the play is all about how he feels about that. And he gets mad because he kills the person who created him. And also the whole of Argos, the whole city, hates him. And he and Electra, who agrees to kill their mother, she's in that as well. They have to go through this trial to decide if they're gonna get killed because they kill her mother, their mother, or if they are going to be exiled from the city. So getting back, when Orestes gets back to Argos, he kills Clytemnestra and he basically goes insane. And all Electra does is take care of her brother. There is a moment when Orestes is talking, oh, why are you taking care of me? Why are you wasting our youth? And she replies, all we have is dust. That reminds me a lot of the way Claudia took care of Louis.
I'm with you 100% on this. And the other thing I think that's important to note is that the many of the writers of this series are playwrights. So it would not surprise me if they, you know, they're sort of drawing from that kind of source material, that they're thinking these things. Certainly they would be aware of it. Whether or not it is conscious or unconscious, I'm 100% with you. And I think it's a very rich reading.
Is this them telling us that this is really going to be a classic tragedy?
Of course, I don't think it's going to be straight up a classic tragedy, but I think it got elements of tragedy, classical tragedies in it. And I think a lot of Louis and Armand's narrative will have a lot of classical tragic elements.
Well, Lestat too.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I mean, he's got the classic Greek flaw.
Hubris.
I mean, yeah. Joni, I know that you are the hugest Lestat fan of all time.
Yeah, for sure.
But would you classify his most tragic flaw as his hubris?
I do.
Or would you assign something else to that?
That's ultimately what brought down his downfall, right? Is his ego. He never thought for one second that Claudia or Louis or anybody could outsmart him. And as he's learning the hard way in a dump somewhere, sucking on rats for sustenance, he can be outsmarted. So it'll be interesting to see if this humbles him in a way. We know it doesn't, but you know, the fact that this doesn't humble him just, you know, speaks more to his hubris. So.
Let me ask this question. Let's go around the table and ask it. Dominique, I'll come to you first. Same question for everybody. Do you think that Lestat was angry at Claudia, or do you think he's kind of like chip off the old block for her masterminding his downfall or his big long pause as he has to try and get healthy again?
I think that in the book, he likes her for a while and then he hates her after what has happened. But I think in the show, he'll hate her a lot more.
Okay, fair. Mark, what do you think? Do you think Lestat is angry or do you think he's a little bit proud?
I think Lestat is not generous enough to be proud that he was outwitted by Claudia. If you remember, when she finally beats him in chess, was he proud or did he flip the table? Right. So I think if you're going to use that chess game as an analogy for her outwitting him at the party, I think you can assume that his reaction will be analogous to when she beat him in chess, too. And it's not like she said, oh, you know, sorry, Lestat, this is just how it goes. No, she sat there and dipped her quill in his neck blood to write the next line in her diary. Not exactly.
His last words.
Yeah. Oh. So I think he is going to flip the table.
He is going to rage. I don't think for one second I agree with Mark. I don't think he's capable of being that deep and saying, you know, stepping back for a second and being proud of the little monster that she is. Perhaps if she'd done that to somebody else, sure. To him, no. Mm-mm. He's going to really not be pleased when he's confronted with her again.
I think Christina's going to break the mold.
I am. I'm going to be the outlier
right,
on this
I like
one.
It.
I am, everyone. I think that there's precedent for this, too, because Lestat, when he was taking Claudia out to hunt, and remember, he was sitting in the car with her and he kind of like he's like, you've been too sheltered, and he touches her hair and stuff. It's kind of a creepy scene. We didn't talk about that scene, but it's a little bit creepery to me. Lestat, calm down. Yeah. But at any rate, I think that Lestat liked that she was like him in that way, that she took after him in her lust for killing. And she really did. She not only did she take after him, she went to far more extravagant and unrestrained levels of murder. And he liked that. I think he admired that about her. In the end, he'll be angry, but I think that there's a part of him that had to look at that and go, God, all right. You know,
nice one.
That's my girl.
You got me.
You know,
zing.
You know, but of course now he's going to spend a lot of time eating rats, and that's not,
he's not
to
like
Lestat's liking. So yeah. I think he'll be angry, but I think that there's going to be some kind of
admiration.
The way that I imagine this is if he comes into contact with Daniel, and then Daniel says, well, you know, you tell me this side of it. Well, Daniel, the way Louis told you, it isn't exactly right. And let me tell you how this was. And honestly, I kind of admired the girl.
Yeah, he's super.
Now, whether or not he's being honest about that, who knows? But I think that he will. I think he kind of admired her for her craftiness.
It's the David Harry all over again.
It is. I know. I always go down these elaborate rabbit holes. Talk about elaborate. I'm the Lestat of the podcast.
You are the Lestat of the podcast.
We already established I'm the Claudia, so I guess that makes Mark the Louis.
That's right.
And I was the Lestat, but I guess Christina's now taking that title.
I guess, maybe. So, Dominique, is there anything more that you want to say about Electra?
That was this part in which Electra says, and I think it suits the Point de Lac / the Leoncourt family very well, in which she says, death breeding death out of death is the law of our house. It all comes down on me. And it so fits them. I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with this. Because Lestat killed Louis just because he wanted Louis to kill. Like, he was in love with Louis. But since the beginning, Lestat is insisting on Louis to kill people. So he just killed him for him to kill more people. So it's just death breeding death out of death, you know? And I think it's Fascinating.
Murder is his love language.
That is. And I mean, that's 100% Claudia, because that's what she's been brought into, too. She was just a young girl. And here, this is obviously a difference between the book and the movie, but Louis is begging for her to be turned. And Lestat at first doesn't want to do it. Now, of course, big departure from the book. Here we go. So Lestat does it. And it is her. It is just death on death on death. And it's people who are being brought into this life in these tremendously traumatic things to live then a life of trauma that is just constant inflicting trauma on people for the vampires to survive. But then also the vampires inflicting trauma upon trauma upon trauma against each other.
It's complicated.
It is an extremely complicated, complex situation and
possibly not healthy.
And relationships.
I think it's really worth at least mentioning the Elektra complex. And I know you don't because you don't want to because it's debunked, which it is, right? But it is not dead as a literary metaphor.
No, you're right.
And it would not have been dead in the time that these books were written.
No, true.
And so the Elektra complex, just oversimplified, is the idea that between the ages of like 3 and 6 or 3 and 8 or something like that, girl children tend to have this unconscious, it's kind of creepy, but unconscious sexual attraction to their father and resent their mothers, right? Who created them. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's why it's called the Elektra complex, because it's, you know, it's similar to the story by Euripides and Sophocles, possibly.
Sophocles.
Yeah. Yeah, Sophocles.
By the way, we also know that the opposite of the Elektra complex is alive and well in the Liancourt family.
Yeah, the Oedipus.
Oh yeah. The Oedipal complex is rampant for not just Lestat, but really throughout Anne Rice's literary collection. I mean, she has no problem with those taboos,
no.
Right? You can definitely make an argument that Claudia's behavior was electoral in nature, and not just historically, but also it's possible that that was an influence for Rice in writing the character. Who knows? I mean, it's a bit of a stretch. No doubt about it that, you know, Lestat has, you know, a fairly complicated relationship with his own mother that is pseudo-sexual.
Right. Now, in the book, I would say it's even more, because there is, you know, how it plays out in the book is that there's an attraction,
yeah,
a love attraction between Louis and Claudia. That does not play out here
he does make that kind of one graphic statement. Right.
She does. Which one of you is going to fuck me? And then obviously neither of them would.
You know, that makes Mark so uncomfortable.
He's so shy.
I really am.
No, you're not. I think that you're not wrong. I think that it applies more to the book. The Elektra complex applies more to the book than it does to the series. But I do. I mean, I'm overwhelmed with that really cool read. And now I'm not going to be, I can't unsee that now. So thanks, Dominique. I'll be looking at the series through that lens now constantly. I've got to go back and watch it because I think that that's 100% correct. Say the quote again. Death upon death upon death. What is it?
Death breeding death out of death is the law of our house. It all comes down on me.
Oh, it is so good.
If people felt interested about the whole Elektra is Claudia and etc., I would recommend reading the play Orestes by Euripides and Sophocles Elektras.
Okay, well, I think what we'll do is wrap up now. Dominique, how can people find you? Can you give out your Twitter and wherever else you might want people to find you if you'd like to get some people to follow you?
Yeah, I'm kind of an old soul, so I just have a Twitter account. I don't have an Instagram or TikTok because I'm scared of TikTok. I don't know how to go there. But yeah, there's my Twitter account that you already said, at EMOS_QUE. And I tweet mostly on Portuguese because I'm Brazilian. And in English, when I talk about more serious stuff and about interview with the vampire as well in the hashtag.
All right. Well, thank you, Dominique, for joining us. We hope that you had a good time. And then, Joe, do you want to take us out?
Thank you to Dominique for joining us and providing insight into the historical aspect of the show. And thank you to all our listeners for taking the time to listen to us each week. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching Vampire Insider. And we are on Twitter at Vampire_Insider. Additionally, you can follow us on our personal accounts. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach. Christina is at Christina Gen X. And I am at JustBlockMe_1. Thank you all again. Have a great night. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.